Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. So happy to be here with you on this Friday afternoon. Maybe it's Friday evening. Maybe it's a Saturday morning where you are. Whatever it is, we're happy you decided to spend the time with us. The number, 888-318-7884. We'll do open forum, second hour with Jimmy Akin. First hour, Trent Horn is here. Author extraordinaire, apologist, speaker, defender of life, defender of the faith. Trent, it's awful nice to see you.
Thank you, Cy. But I think last year from the annual yearbook of titles, Apologist Extraordinaire was retired.
Oh, we got rid of Apologist Extraordinaire. I apologize.
Yes, we actually, well, for all the apologists, like how the Pope has a list of titles in the Pontifical Yearbook, we do the same for us. And every now and then a few do get retired. So it was appropriate for a certain age. But now as we relate to the modern world.
We've moved into the modern world. Yeah,
fancy. It may be a bit out of touch for people.
Okay. Yeah. You're familiar with Servant of the Servants of God as a title for the Pope.
Oh, yeah. That one goes all the way back to 5th, 6th century. Yeah.
So servant of the rest of the people at Catholic Answers is a possible title we could give you.
It could be a helper to the other apologists.
Oh, you're going to go with that. All right. Well,
you know what's actually interesting? The last time, I think it was back in 2018, we retired Boy Wonder. I think we finally retired that.
That's a Chris Jeck thing. I forgot he used to call you Boy Wonder all the time.
Yeah. Now people... There's a transition for that, I think, as apologists. It starts with, you look so young, and then it turns into, you look so tired. And
yeah, so well, I think that after child number three, it became you look so tired.
Basically.
888-318-7884. If you'd like tips for defending the faith, Trent is awful good at it. He'd love to help you out with it. Trent, if you don't know also, the full story of all the books Trent's written and all the debates he does and all that, the most important thing to know is, of course, Trent is married to Laura Horn. And you've probably seen her on your internet feed doing her, what I think of as comedic videos, Too Far with Laura Horn. What do you think of them? Do you think of them as comedic videos?
I consider them comedic gold. I consider comedy them gold. Comedic art. Yes, comedy gold.
Comedy gold.
Oh, they're, well, what's funny is now she is graciously including me in more and more videos. I think my role in that is to be the straight man to her.
Yeah, that's that. I've noticed that emerging, and I think that's a good choice because she's funny.
That's true. So who is the straight man? So there was Jerry Lee Lewis, and then he would
no,
often work
there was some Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yes.
Jerry Lee Lewis plays the piano. Jerry Lee Lewis is a rock and roll man. You mean Jerry Lewis.
Jerry Lewis.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And it was...
I could have still maybe gotten... they wouldn't have given it to me on Jeopardy.
Boy, now I'm going to go back to calling you Boy Wonder. Dean Martin was the straight man.
It was Dean Martin, yeah. Yes. So I'm the Dean Martin to Laura's Jerry Lewis.
All right. Let's hear you sing Volare.
Oh, no. The problem is I sound too much more like Jerry Lewis.
Lighty. 888-318-7884 is the number. Trent Horn is our guest. Your call is welcome. If you have a question about the faith, about how to defend, if you want to defend an idea, like defend the idea of God or the divinity of Jesus, you're perfectly welcome to call with those questions as well. So I say that by way of saying you don't have to be Catholic to call. We share the faith in many ways with others. So if you'd like some help in those areas, 888-318-7884. You feel ready to go to the phones?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, because the phone's filled up really quick when you got here. Let's go to Canada. Vince is in Canada. Vince, thank you so much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. So first off, I don't really know much about the Synod on synodality. I just hear a lot of Catholics kind of attacking it or not really supporting it. So first off, what is it? And second off, are we supposed to be defending this or,
okay,
or was it not the best thing to happen?
The synod and synodality. What do you say, Trent?
Yeah, so the synods typically involve collections or meetings of representatives within the church. Throughout the church's history, typically these are gatherings of bishops. They weren't necessarily... like all the bishops of the world, like when all the bishops of the world gather, that would be an ecumenical council. These would be, you might have things like collections of bishops gathering to discuss specific issues, for example. Though now there has been a focus in the synod to include also lay representatives from different areas. So now this is kind of a global synod going over a course of about 3 years to be a listening session for the bishops to be able to hear from different members of the laity and to understand the needs of the church kind of in the modern world. So when it comes to defending it, I mean, the church certainly has the right to host these kinds of listening sessions and these meetings of bishops and to be informed by different people. But this isn't a doctrine. This is a prudential matter as to how these listening sessions are conducted, how teachings are understood from it. So it's fine to even to say, well, yeah, I have the church obviously has the right to do this, and to say, yeah, maybe there's some things that are done in it that are not the best way to carry it out, aren't the most prudent or aren't helpful. For example, I've read some reports that the voices in the synod tend to be overrepresented of certain demographics. Like, I think women over the age of 60 are a very overrepresented demographic. I know I've attended multiple parishes and I've never heard an invite to be part of the synod, these kind of listening sessions, to be a part of it, to these reports taken from different countries and then sent to Rome. So I think questions of representation, I think there's a fear that you had people in the church, those who are most eager to take part in this, to say, we're going to tell the bishops and the Pope that we want so-called same-sex marriage, or, you know, we want female ordination, or, you know, we want even, you know, or married priests. And I think it's important to understand that the church, that the bishops should listen to the laity. In fact, Canon 212 in the Code of Canon Law says that the laity have the right to make their spiritual needs known to their pastors. But at the same time, they don't just rubber stamp whatever the laity suggest in these types of ventures. So I think it's important to keep in mind a trust in the Holy Spirit, that even when the magisterium opens itself up to listening to the world and gets a lot of bad advice, the Spirit will guide the church to separate the wheat from the chaff. To give two previous examples of something like this, you have, for example, the Theological Commission on Birth Control that was started by Pope Paul VI's predecessor. I guess that'd be, was that Pope John Paul no, it wouldn't be the first, obviously, he's before Pope John Paul II. The 23rd?
Wait.
How can I? Yeah, right? Right before Pope Paul VI?
John the 23rd.
Yeah, John the 23rd. Yeah. Not John Paul I, right? Pope John the 23rd, and then later started under Pope Paul VI. Was basically bringing in scientists. You'll talk about overpopulation and the birth control pill. And here's a married couple, and they did a survey. And their surveys, everybody said they really want to use contraception. And the commission, there was a majority of people on it that voted for the church to change its teaching on birth control. And Pope Paul VI remained firm. He wanted to hear these arguments, hear these reasons, be tested. But he reaffirmed the teaching Humana Vitae. You look the same at the Amazonian Synod a few years ago. People were saying that after the Amazonian Synod, there are going to be sweeping changes in the church. There's going to be female deacons, going to be married priests, and or even a new Amazonian rite. And that didn't emerge from it. And now some of these changes, I have to point out, by the way, would be licit. I've noticed some people saying that it would be count against the church's infallibility in some way if the church were to change the teaching on whether priests have to be celibate. That is something we've said for a long, long time. That is a discipline. It's not a doctrine of the church, because there are married clergy in the East and Anglican priests to convert. So the church could change the discipline, open up for married priests. So there could be a debate about whether that's a good idea or not. So I think that we should pray for the synod, pray for the bishops, and just trust in the Holy Spirit and say, yeah, there's aspects of this that we could be critical of, but you don't want to operate under a fear of what might be when that hasn't happened yet. And cognitive behavioral therapy is a branch of therapy for people who deal with stress and things like that. And there's a great book on it called The Worry Cure, actually. So in cognitive behavioral therapy, that's called catastrophizing, where you become really, really anxious about something bad that might happen. But there's really no use in doing that because it hasn't happened yet. You're just getting yourself all worked up, kind of. So that might be the advice that I would give. Always pray and let's not catastrophize, because we have trust in the Holy Spirit to guide the church. But I hope that was helpful, and thank you so much for calling in.
Thanks, Vince, for getting us started. We got to take a quick break. There's two lines open if you've got a question for Trent. Tips for defending the faith this hour, 888-318-6007. 7884.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Beyond Damascus with Dan Demite and Aaron Richards is our show for young adults.
Everybody's talking about encounter. Everybody's talking about that mountaintop experience. What we fail to often talk about is what happens after. What happens beyond that Damascus moment?
Jesus Christ is calling all of us to be missionary disciples, disciples of Jesus who are on mission to bring the kingdom of God here and now on this earth.
Beyond Damascus with Dan Demite and Aaron Richards, tomorrow at 8 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Tips for defending the faith this hour with Trent Horn. 888-318-7884 is our number. Before I go back to the phones, Carrie, who writes these ad scripts and gives them to me to read every day, he wrote this. And it's about himself. He wrote about himself in the ad script today. In 1958, Carrie was born. Eddie Cochran sang the tune, Ain't No Cure for the Summertime Blues. But Catholic Answers has a cure for your summertime blues, and it's not that complicated. It's our summertime $10 book sale with 25 of our bestsellers and newest titles on sale for just $10 a copy. You can check it all out at shop.catholic.com. No promo code needed. He should have put promo code Happy Birthday Carrie on there. This special offer is available through Monday, June 26, midnight, Honolulu time. It ends. Happy shopping at shop.catholic.com. Ava is in Ontario, Canada. Ava, welcome back.
Hello, thank you.
I got Canada right this time.
Yes, you did.
Were you listening yesterday at all, Ava?
I wasn't, no.
Because a man called from Ontario, California, and I just didn't trust it.
Oh, really?
I was scared to say Ontario, California because of how many times I messed up yours. But all right, so thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Thank you. I was once talking with a Protestant friend that we had, and he was talking about why he wasn't Catholic. And one of the things he brought up was that Catholics have killed a lot of people. And he brought up the Inquisition and stuff. But one thing he brought up that I didn't know how to respond to was he said that Catholics burned a lot of witches. And I wasn't sure exactly how to respond to that.
I think we had a little sound glitch there. She said witches, just so you know. The word was
right,
witches.
Right, yes.
Okay.
Witches.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, so I think I would ask him, you know, well, why does that show the Catholic Church is not the church that Christ established, for example? So I think I would engage in a lot of Socratic dialogue with him to say, like, okay, how does the fact that the church burned witches at the stake, the allegation that you're making, why would that disprove Catholicism? So you want to dig deeper there, because if it's just, well, the church did bad things, well, the church are collections of people throughout time who hold to a common faith, and people can do bad things. Now, you might say, well, the church would never teach anything false, and it's false, you know, the idea that it's okay to burn a witch at the stake, someone for the crime of witchcraft. So the church is wrong, basically. Do you think that might be an argument he would make, that, like, you know, it's wrong to burn witches at the stake, the church taught this was okay, so I can't believe in the Catholic Church? Do you think that might be kind of where he's going with this?
That would probably be one reason.
Yeah. The problem here, I mean, there's a few issues here. So he's Protestant?
He is Protestant.
Yeah. So I guess what I would ask him is, what does he think of Exodus 22:18? So this is part of the law codes for ancient Israel. Exodus 22:18 says, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. So they might not have burned at the stake, but one of the crimes punishable by capital punishment in the Old Testament was witchcraft. So as a Protestant, he's kind of in a little bit of a bind here. So if he says that the Catholic Church is wrong because it taught it was okay to execute someone for witchcraft, then he's going to have to say that the Bible was wrong. But if he believes that the Bible is without error, well, then he's got problematic elements here. If he says, well, no, it's not wrong, that's just something that was for a particular time and place, it's not something we would do now, it was Israel's law code, not something we would do now, then we can argue the same thing for the Catholic Church when it allowed the burning of witches, the execution of witches in the Middle Ages. Some of that was for things like sorcery or magic. Other things were for witches providing abortifacient potions. They were involved in homicide, essentially. They were practicing abortion and other crimes related to that. So when it comes to his argument, though, we can say as Catholics, look, even though the church taught that the death penalty and different forms of the death penalty, like methods of execution, were used to promote the common good at certain times, we can understand that now in the present, it's not something that ought to be done. And even back then, there may have been things that had been practiced. They weren't a teaching of the church. It's not like the church taught as official doctrine, this is the way one ought to treat witches. This was a civil matter. This was how laws promoting the common good were carried out. And you could say, look, we can look back on this and say, yeah, the way the church carried out punishment in the Middle Ages, engaging in things like torture or other kinds of ways to promote the common good, the church was mistaken in how to, in some of these elements. I would say for some of the elements, there were things that had to be tolerated to promote the common good, like the death penalty. If you don't have maximum security prisons, you don't have a lot of options to deal with people who are a genuine threat to society, who are going to go around murdering people, things like that. But in other cases, you have things like the use of torture during the Inquisition, other things like this, the use of execution by burning at the stake, to say, yeah, there were church officials that thought this is the best way to promote the common good, but they were wrong in what they were choosing, and now we've come to see that. The church's infallibility only applies to things it officially teaches and defines to be infallible in matters of faith and morals. And the way the death penalty ought to be carried out is certainly not one of those things. In fact, there's a paragraph in the Catechism here that's interesting. This is paragraph 2298. And it says, in times past, cruel practices were commonly used by legitimate governments to maintain law and order, often without protest from the pastors of the church, who themselves adopted in their own tribunals the prescriptions of Roman law concerning torture. Regrettable as these facts are, the church always taught the duty of clemency and mercy. She forbade clerics to shed blood. In recent times, it has become evident that these cruel practices were neither necessary for public order nor in conformity with the legitimate rights of the human person. On the contrary, these practices led to ones even more degrading. It is necessary to work for their abolition. We must pray for the victims and their tormentors. Paragraph 2298 of the Catechism. So I think what I would focus on, your friend, is to go at this route, to say, if you're saying that teaching that the execution of witches means, you're just wrong, well, he's going to have a hard time explaining Exodus 22:18 and where the Bible describes being able to do that. If he says that this was something provisional, okay, well, that applies to the church as well. So that'd be number one, comparison to the Bible. Number two, I think you would just say to him, look, not everything the church did in the past 2,000 years was good, because the church are people, and people aren't always good. We have to compare the church's official teachings, especially those that are infallibly defined. But we have to separate the teachings, the doctrines, from the practices. And some of the practices in a core of medieval society were wrong. And so we've developed and understood, yeah, we ought not do that anymore. Even people who defend the death penalty today, I think, would say, we shouldn't burn people at the stake. We should carry that out in a humane way. And then number three, I think you should bring up to him, look, it wasn't just Catholics. This is something that was common in medieval society. All of the witches that were hung in the New World, for example, like at Salem, the Salem witchcraft trials, those were done by Puritan Protestants. Now, he might try to say, well, that's not the Protestantism I believe in. So that's why you might have to point back at the Bible. But I would just say, the comparison of the Bible, and then distinguish practices from doctrine. And the practices may not always be right, but we understand, the church grows in its understanding of what is prudent and moral in the public, to secure the common good in the public order, and what isn't. So that might be where I would start with that. Is that helpful? Would you like a follow-up on any of the points that I raised?
I think that makes a lot of sense. So you could say that it's even if it was wrong to burn people at the stake, it was what they did back then in the church. The people in the church aren't infallible. So even if it's wrong to burn people, that doesn't mean the Catholic Church is wrong.
That's right, because the church didn't infallibly teach that it's always okay to burn people at the stake or something like that. There, you should say there's a difference between what the church teaches as doctrine and what it practices. And also you have to remember that in 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, this was when the church and the state were very, very close together. So you have the church and the state working together to carry out things like civil punishment, for example, for breaking laws. And even during this time period, you had criminals would ask to be tried in church courts rather than state courts, because church courts were more merciful towards those who were accused of various crimes. So to separate the doctrine from the practices, point out that, hey, the Bible also talks about executing witches, but you don't throw out the Bible. Protestants also did this, but you don't throw out Protestantism. And to say the church can learn and grow and understand, yeah, those practices were not okay. And we've developed in our understanding of how the public order should be preserved and protected, while carrying out the timeless teachings on human dignity. So Eva, if you want to stay on the line, maybe we could send you our book, 20 Myths About Catholic History by Steve Weidenkopf. I forget the exact title. Cy would know it maybe. But Steve Weidenkopf, what is it?
No, I was just going to say, we got to send her an electronic link because she's in Canada.
We'll send you an electronic ebook. Steve Weidenkopf's book on church history about myths about Catholic history. You might find that to be very helpful. And if you ever want any follow-up on this or anything else, just give us a call back. And I wish we could send you a Why We're Catholic to give to your Protestant friend, but I'm sure you can get one at amazon.ca. But I hope that's helpful for you.
It's that great Canada United States rivalry. We can't mail into Canada for some reason. I don't know what that's about.
Some reason.
It just costs a lot of money, I think. I think that's why we don't do it. I'm not sure, but yeah. Eva, hang on the line. We'll get some address that we can send you the electronic link. Luke's in Arkansas listening on the Catholic Answers app. Luke, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Thank you, guys. I mean, like, my coworker and I, it's mainly just him and me throughout the day. And so, like, we've been getting to, like, theological discussions and stuff. And, like, he's not Catholic, but he knows that I am. And so I try to answer some questions the best way I can. And so I'm trying to figure out, like, over the past few years, I've been trying to, like, learn more, like, and learn more in theology. And then, but, like, how do I become a good apologist? Because I remember hearing someone say that, like, just because you're a good theologian doesn't make you a good apologist. So I'm like, what are some good skills for becoming a good apologist?
Well, you call the right place for that. I would say the steps to becoming a good apologist are first to learn the faith very well, then to learn the reasons for the faith that justify believing in it, then to learn the objections and arguments against it and how to answer them, and finally to learn what other people believe and what are the problems with those worldviews, whether they're non-religious, religious, competing religions, whatever they may be. So it's kind of a four-step process. Learn the faith, reasons for the faith, objections to the faith, and then the problems with other belief systems is kind of where you would go. So the first step, I mean, is like becoming a good theologian, theology student, just learning the faith. Read the catechism, read the New Testament. And then the catechism has a lot of great apologetic notes in it. So I would focus on that. And then just lightly going to different topics and picking up little arguments along the way. And as you get more comfortable with that, then doing a deep dive into a particular topic, like the perpetual virginity of Mary or the resurrection, finding one book on that subject and reading just one book that covers that subject. So a good starter for Broadview would be Daily Defense by Jimmy Akin. So actually, Luke, if you stay on the line, let's let's get you two things. Let's get you daily defense. Well, we'll get you daily defense by Jimmy Akin. That's a great start. It's a nice little appetizer sampler of apologetics. And then you could branch this. Hey, I'd like to learn more about this subject. Then you would just go to a book just on that. And then when you feel comfortable with the subject, yeah, I've learned a lot about that. To become a good apologist, you would listen to critics develop their arguments, and then you would write down their arguments and critique them, basically. So stay on the line, Lucas. We'll get you, Luke, we'll give that to you. And I hope it benefits you.
Thanks, Luke. Hang on. We're going to get to you. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come right back with more questions for Trent. It's Tips for Defending the Faith on Catholic Answers Live. The number, 888-318-7884. Want to get right to the core of Christ's saving message? Want a roadmap for living the life Christ calls you to? It's time to look again at the Beatitudes. In his new book, Heart of the Gospel, How the Beatitudes Show Us God's Plan for Happiness, Father Sebastian Walsh demonstrates compellingly how these eight declarations make up the foundation, the essence, and the final goal of Jesus' teaching. Heart of the Gospel illuminates the scriptural passages from which we get the Beatitudes, explains the significance of their wording, their order, and their timing in Jesus' ministry. And it draws out edifying parallels and connections with salvation history and the lives of the saints. Most importantly, Father Walsh offers wise counsel from his own work as a priest and teacher to help you live the Beatitudes in your own life. Order your copy of Heart of the Gospel today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Every now and then, no, I shouldn't say every now and then, probably like every hour, maybe every half hour, maybe every 10 minutes, I don't know, the Catholic faith is getting challenged on the internets, on some social media posts somewhere. Sometimes they're awful clever, these posts. Sometimes you just kind of smack your forehead and go, really? They think that's a good critique of the Catholic Church? Well, on TikTok, we respond to some of those. Thomas, the TikTok engine here at Catholic Answers, responds to them. And one of the ways he does that is he gets other people to do his work for him. He comes here live, shares the challenge that he got on TikTok. Trent or whoever's here answers, and then Thomas goes and posts that back to TikTok. So welcome, Thomas, the TikTok engine. Thank you for coming.
Hi, Cy. Thanks for making it seem like I do less work than I do.
I apologize. Now I feel terrible.
No, I'm very open about
terrible.
That as well.
I feel so bad. The hardest working man in Catholic media, Thomas the TikTok engine.
It's a great gig if you can get it. So Trent, I'll let you decide which level of competence this TikTok comment comes from that Cy gave us the spectrum earlier. This person commented, if the world ended tomorrow and humans came back, religions would be different, but properties of science would be the same. What do you make of that?
I pretty low confidence in that being a good argument. Notice there's also no conclusion in that argument. I would say, okay, so what? What would that prove? I think the implicit assumption is that the religions would not come back. So that shows the religions are false, but science would come back. And so it's true. So I have a few thoughts on that. Number one, not all of the science would come back necessarily. If people failed to discover certain things, that science would not come back. Those scientific laws would still be true, but people would have failed to discover them. So they wouldn't all necessarily come back. Number two, some religious truths would come back. You have to separate religious truths between philosophical truths and historical truths. So some religious truths or doctrines are that God exists and God created the world and God gave us the moral law to follow. Well, I don't know exactly what the questioner means by humans came back. Maybe he means the world would end and then, like, you know, billions of years later, there'd be evolution and humans would evolve again. However, humans come back in this example, they'd probably still ask questions like, why is there something rather than nothing? Why does it seem like there's a moral law I ought to follow that transcends time, place, and culture? So religious truths that are philosophical in nature, they would come back. Now, it's true, some historical truths would not come back. You know, maybe truths about the incarnation, Christ dying and rising from the dead, or other religious historical truths would not come back. But that doesn't prove those religious historical truths are false, because no historical truths would come back. We wouldn't know about Napoleon at Waterloo. We wouldn't know about the 2016 election. No historical truths would come back, but they still happened. They were still true. So the fact that we wouldn't know them again would not disprove them in any way. So this argument fails to disprove anything about religion whatsoever. It fails to show that science is superior to religion in any respect.
All right. Thanks, Trent. That's pretty convincing.
So if the world ended, how would humanity come back? Or we don't specify that in this. This is just a...
The great wise commenters on TikTok don't give us that much information.
Yeah, that's my question too. How do we come back if the world ended? I guess maybe the only way I can think of is maybe the cockroaches are left and in 5 billion years or whatever, they evolve into humans. But then again, by the way,
cockroach
some of the science...
People.
Yeah, but the science might be different too. If evolution happened all over again,
who knows? Maybe cockroach people are better at math than we are. Maybe they can do science better than we can.
Maybe they're better.
Maybe they're better
managers.
Philosophers yeah. than we are, and they do religion better than us. Yeah. All right. So finally, whenever we get to the part where we're talking about the rise of the cockroach people, mm-hmm. We are done, Thomas. Thank you very much.
All right. See you next time.
Thanks, Thomas.
I, for one, welcome our cockroach overlords.
Welcome, cockroach overlords. What can I do for you? Tim in Rockport, Indiana, you are up next. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Hey, Trent. My question is, to set things up, I'm the only Catholic in my family. I'm a convert. And at a recent family gathering, a funeral... my uncle, through whom I became a believing Christian, who's a Assemblies of God minister and cousin, remarked about a picture online that looks like a snake, and it was compared to a Vatican building.
Oh,
and
right.
They were making much of this, and at the time, I might have been prepared to talk about history or theology or something like that, but I didn't know what to do. And I prayed to the Holy Spirit, and I just ended up, I kind of got that there was nothing to say about it.
Yeah.
I just made a remark that Photoshop can do amazing things. And sometimes my mom will make underhanded remarks and stuff. It's not direct, and I don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah. When you have family is always difficult because you want to maintain those familial bonds, but nobody knows how to push your buttons like family. Family knows how to just make the most efficient little jabs and cuts to hurt one's feelings in a way that they try to write off as being playful banter. Family are good at that, and it can be hurtful. So there's a number of ways. It sounds like you handled it just fine. I mean, the worst way you could handle it is just to erupt, to become overly emotional, to be malicious in the words that you say in response. It's better to keep quiet than to be angry at them in this way. So there's a few different options you can take, and you'll have to pray to see which one is an option you feel is best for you. One is just to politely nod and just accept the jab and let it be like water rolling off your back. You know, just, okay, all righty, that's interesting. And then you just let it go. And that can frustrate them that you won't take the bait and get upset. Number two approach is a Socratic investigation. So to ask questions like, oh, how do you know this building at the Vatican is shaped like a snake? Oh, how do you know that that's real and not fake? Even if it were real, so what would that prove? Like, what would that prove? You're saying the Catholic Church, the entire thing, everything the Catholic Church is wrong on everything because some guy in Rome built a weird building? How does that follow? I don't understand. Or when there's little jabs, you ask questions like, how do you know that's true? What does that prove? Why should I think that? If you want to, and always keep a lot of questions and focus them on the main issue. Number three, you can try to be humorous back, like, oh, I never heard that one before. Or, you know, just try to tell a little joke in reply to try to neutralize it. Number four is you could say, well, you have to watch this one. This one is not for the faint of heart always, but to give a little jab back in reply. Someone says, you know, oh, Catholics. Yeah, it's not like Catholics ever read the Bible. Like, oh, yeah, I guess people do say that. It's so funny, though. Without us, you wouldn't have a Bible. You know, that. So like I said, I'm putting different options on the table. Some people want to play with fire and they want to get a little spicy with others and engage others in that way with a playful jab back at the same level. Although if you're hesitant, you're not sure that's a good idea, just do Socratic questioning or prayerful silence. I think those are the different options that would be on the table. That one, the jab back, is the most dangerous. I would reserve that for when you're really confident it'll be received well, or you feel like it ought to be done. The others, though, I think are, one was the humor back, that could fall flat. Prayerful silence and gracious Socratic questioning are always good bets when you're engaging others. Is that helpful?
Yes.
Tim? Yeah. I'm glad that that's helpful. I want to add just one little thing to you. I want to suggest a video to you, right? Because I think that this will help you with to the kind of patience that you need in order to bear with those jabs. We have a video up that 160,000 people have viewed now. It's from Dan Burke, and it's called From a Cult to Catholic. Now, you might think that that has nothing to do with what you're talking about, and the title, it doesn't. But what he does is tell stories about the people who brought him to Christ, and his theme is that love builds a bridge to truth. And he was a Protestant who hated Catholics. And there's there's bits in there about, especially about one particular Catholic woman who he was mean to and who he made these jabs to, and what worked on his heart in that regard. I think you'll find it very encouraging. It's for free. It's up on YouTube. It's called From a Cult to Catholic. And we've never had a response like this to any video we've ever produced. So I think you'll really enjoy it. Take a look if you think that would be helpful and provide you with some encouragement. And thank you very, very much for the call. Trent Horn's our guest. It's Tips for Defending the Faith this hour. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with more questions for Trent right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley of the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
He was a Jesuit, a cardinal, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Robert Bellarmine is honored for his immense contributions to theology, including helping to draft two important catechisms that defended church teachings during the Protestant Revolt. Pope Clement VIII named Bellarmine a cardinal because, as the Pope put it, Bellarmine had not his equal for learning.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I'm so happy those days when people couldn't come in the building are over. One of the best things that happens to us is when people come and visit, and lots of people come in the summertime. Right now in the studio with us is Lucas from Albuquerque, and he and his family have traveled here from Albuquerque. And the family drove.
Yep.
And you're kind of on your summer vacation tour together as a family.
Yes.
And how many brothers and sisters do you have? Like, it's very impressive when a family is so large. I don't know. Someone has to tell me how many of the kids that is. How many of you are there?
I have three sisters and a brother, and sometimes it feels like there's twice as much.
The brothers feels like twice as much, or the sisters?
All of them.
Oh, all of them. All right. Are you the oldest?
Yes.
Yeah. Because you probably feel like, well, we were fine without all these other kids. I didn't need them. All right. Well, we're very glad you're here. You come from a lovely family. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
All right. Well, I recently took world history, and, you know, they have the whole teaching about Galileo and the Galilean persecution. And I'm just wondering, how would you respond to that? Because I've looked around and I haven't really found anything that could work satisfactorily.
Right. I think what we have to do when this comes up is be very clear what is being attacked here. To say, look, the church was wrong about Galileo. Okay, well, what does that prove? And someone might say, well, it proves the church is wrong, or the church is not established by Christ. You might say, well, why should I believe that? Are you saying that every single thing the church does is going to be perfect? Catholics don't believe that. Catholics do not teach that. The church teaches that what it defines infallibly is without error. So what the church teaches at an ecumenical council, or when the Pope speaks ex cathedra, when the church solemnly teaches something is infallible, that it is without error, that is when the Holy Spirit protects the church from making an error. It doesn't prevent the church from making those kinds of errors in its ordinary teaching, for example. It especially doesn't do that in its discipline. This is similar to the caller earlier in the show that had the question about burning witches. There's a difference between what the church teaches and what the church practices, you know, what it believes is the best way to promote the common good in society. The church might be wrong about that in some cases. And so here, this is about a disciplinary matter. So I think there's things to clear up is that the church was not opposed to the theory of heliocentrism, the idea that the sun, that the earth goes around the sun itself per se, because it was open to these kinds of models. Copernicus dedicated his heliocentric model, his writing on it, to the Pope. I think it was called On the Celestial Orbs. So Copernicus had dedicated it to, I think he might've been a deacon or a minor order actually within the church. So this was not like a completely forbidden view to investigate, but the church wanted the Pope at the time, I think it was Urban VIII who ratified the punishments of Galileo, wanted caution. Like, he didn't want people to rush out to say, hey, guess what? Turns out the earth goes around the sun, because some people might be confused. Say, oh, wait a minute. Well, how do we read then in Joshua when it says that the sun was made to stand still? I thought it says in the Bible that the sun rises, the sun sets, it moves in its course. How do I understand all of that? So the Pope doesn't want people rushing. And Galileo wanted to rush. And so the Pope made his arguments. And Galileo, even atheists have said, yeah, this is misrepresented, because Galileo went on to write a dialogue, the Dialogue on the Two Worlds. And one of the characters in it was based on the Pope. And his Italian name was Simplicio, which means simpleton or stupid. So if you're going to, the problem is medieval popes don't like being called Simplicios. And so that led to his censure at a tribunal, at a trial. And then he was placed under house arrest for what he was doing that was scandalizing people. But the church now, Pope St. John Paul II, apologized for some ways that this tribunal handled what Galileo had done. And we can say, yeah, there were some rash judgments that were made that should not have been made. There are worries about this impacting the faith that did not have to be made. So I think you can separate the doctrine from the practices. It's about prudently sharing this new data with the world. And some ways Galileo were not just. But this does not show the church is wrong, because the church never infallibly said Galileo was wrong, or never infallibly taught that geocentrism is true. One of the cardinals at the time of this affair said, the church teaches people how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And it's also good that the church didn't say, yeah, the church endorses Galileo's model. Galileo is right. Because Galileo got some things wrong. He thought that the planets orbited the sun in a perfect circle. They actually don't. Kepler discovered they are in elliptical orbit. So separating the doctrine from the practices, this has never been infallibly defined, and this is what a tribunal did. And we're free to say that some ways it treated Galileo may not have been the most just or fair way to do that, and the church has learned from that. But the church really was the biggest promoter of astronomy in the Middle Ages and beyond. Astronomers were funded and supported so that they could understand how the heavens worked, because you built cathedrals, you'd spend 100 years building a cathedral, and you had to have it designed just right so that the sun in a certain part of the year would illuminate a certain stained glass window to shine in a certain way on like a feast day. So the church really did support astronomy. The Galileo affair is just more complicated. I hope that provides a good summary. If you, since you're there in person, we can give you, Chris Check has a wonderful talk on Galileo. We can refer you to, and probably,
maybe the Weidenkopf book.
Let's give him a copy of that.
Well, I was going to give him the Galileo Affair, which I think that's the title of your talk, Chris. Chris, I'm just looking at. But is Claire here to tell us we have a Catholic Answer School of Apologetics course on Galileo? You want to give him the School of Apologetics course, or give him a choice and make him make the choice right in front of Chris? He can either have Chris's talk, or he can have the. Oh, it's your class. You teach the class. Okay, so Chris teaches the class.
Wait.
So you're leaving here with something. I don't know what it's going to be, but it's going to be an education in Galileo. Chris is here.
Oh, okay. Chris, I do an okay job on that one, because he's more the Galileo expert than I am.
Just walked in, Trent, but I'm sure it was excellent.
He didn't hear the whole thing. Yeah. All right.
It was great. Didn't hear any of it.
Well, Lucas, was that helpful to you?
It very much was. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming in, and head out and get your prize. Go get your fabulous room full of gifts and prizes. The number is 888-318-7884. Second hour is going to be open forum with Jimmy Akin. This hour, tips for defending the faith with Trent Horn. And now we are going to line one? You want me to go to line one? Okay, Bob in Houston, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. Bob, thanks for waiting while we got to talk with Lucas. Go ahead with your question for Trent.
Now, my question is, why has the Catholic Church not aggressively gone after the American sexual revolution and really in public and showed why they are wrong? Because right the way it is right now, you've got this guy, Kinsey, he's the one that started it back in 1950. You got Hefner, of course, he's dead now, head of Playboy, and you got Bob Guccione was head of Penthouse, and then you got that wacko Larry Flint, who was head over that Hustler magazine.
Well, you don't have to name every pornographer. We get the idea, though. But you don't think that the church is standing up to the sexual revolution properly?
Absolutely, they haven't said it. They never say anything about it in Sunday in the sermon. I never hear anything.
I feel sympathetic to that. Trent, how would you respond to that?
Yeah, I guess, Bob, I would say, well, one, this is a question of why don't you say more? That doesn't show whether the church is right or wrong. I mean, the church can make a teaching and then fail to be courageous to speak out on things. But number two, we have to say, well, are we looking at everything and what the church says? What more should the church do? Is the church going to call out every single sinner by name and condemn them? That's not really how the church functions. The church condemns sin and calls people to repentance. I think the one thing I would say, like the idea that the Catholic Church has not stood against the sexual revolution, Bob, how many churches openly teach that contraception is evil?
No, I put Bob on hold. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bob.
We have a lot of problems with Christian churches not standing up for what the Bible says. I mean,
well, Bob, hold on a minute.
We should be taking what the Bible, what did Jesus say about it?
Yeah, okay. I agree with that. Go ahead.
Yeah, here's what I would say. That how has the church stood up against the sexual revolution? What other church has publicly said contraception is intrinsically evil? What other church?
Well, it's one thing to say it, but then it's one thing to say it, but it's another thing to back it up with the real cold hard goods that will leave no doubt that the Catholic Church knows what they're talking about.
Now, like what?
Like what? Like what Jesus said. Jesus told his disciples to feed his flock. Now that means also about that took in everything, including sexuality.
Okay.
I wonder if Bob is aware, there's
an awful lot of Catholic work in this regard, and not all of it is being done by bishops, but there's the laity are doing this work. I'm thinking of Jennifer Robach Morris over at the Ruth Institute, what we do here at Catholic Answers.
But also the bishops. You have the bishops affirming the church's teaching, and the two biggest elements would be the wrongness of contraception and the wrongness of remarriage after divorce. And you might say, oh, it's one thing to say something. It is one thing when no other church, major church at least, or major denomination has held firm on those two doctrines like the Catholic Church has. It was the Catholic Church that started the National Right to Life Committee. They're the ones that the Catholic Church started the pro-life movement in the 1960s and 70s. Everybody agrees on that. And Protestants were kind of late joining the movement. They kind of got in more in the 1980s. And even still, it's very hard. When you see people praying outside of abortion facilities, 9 times out of 10, it's Catholics, not Protestants. When you see a cleric there praying, it's a priest or a bishop who will lead a procession or who will speak at a March for Life. So I just reject Bob's supposition there, I guess. Though I think there is a kernel, I understand his complaint that if you're judging it by the homily you hear on Sundays, then I understand his concern is that's more of homilies can be very lackluster. Though I do feel for a priest on a Sunday, it's pretty hard to preach about pornography when you have, you know, an 8-year-old kid in the pew staring back at you, you know, or to preach about contraception when everybody there's contraception. You preach about divorce when so many people in the congregation have been divorced and are remarried. And sometimes it's done, although out of fear, other times it's done out of misplaced prudence. It's difficult when you're not in that position. So I do think that's a legitimate concern to have about lackluster homilies that kind of all seem kind of bland and blend together and don't really equip the laity and preach on these powerful issues. But that's why we need to pray for priests and provide them resources so that they can preach on these controversial issues and help others. Though when it comes to standing up against pornography, standing up against these kinds of things, I think the Catholic Church has earned a reputation in our culture for being backwards or on the wrong side of history when it comes to homosexuality, when it comes to contraception, sexuality. So I really do think if you ask the culture, like, what Christians are, you know, most wrong on sexuality, they're going to say very, very, very passionate evangelicals and the Catholic Church is going to be basically the two they would pick. And then maybe Mormons coming up on the back end, I guess. I don't know. So, let's pray for our priests so that they can courageously speak out on these issues in a way that's hard on a Sunday for them to do.
I'd like to send you a book if you'd like. It's called Inseparable. It's a book that we did here on the 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae. It's just an example of some of what's going on because as you're speaking, I'm just thinking of so many people Pope John Paul II devoted a large part of the energy of his papacy to resisting the sexual revolution. Yeah. So it's hard for me to be... I'm sympathetic to the preaching side of it, but as Trent said, do you really want preaching on pornography on Sunday? You don't want very much of it. So if you'd like the book Inseparable, I'd like to send it to you because it's a wonderful reflection on the Catholic view of marriage and human sexuality. I think that's about going to do it for us. Trent, tell us what's happening over at trenthorn.com.
Well, we have wonderful podcasts that are coming out each week. Also, I have a new feature for the podcast for our patrons, a weekly live stream every Wednesday night at 8:15 p.m. Eastern, 5:15 p.m. Pacific. Every Wednesday night, I'm just hanging out with my patrons, and you can come and join and ask questions and just hang out with me. Go to trenthornpodcast.com. You can take part in a Wednesday live stream for all our patrons. That's at trenthornpodcast.com.
Hey, if you're on the line, stay on the line because Jimmy's coming and your question will work for Open Forum as well. If you haven't called yet and you've got a question appropriate for Open Forum, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not, whether you're a believer of any kind or not, your call is welcome. 888-318-7884. Thanks, Mr. Laura Horn. Appreciate your the hour.
Always glad to be the other part of the duo. She's, you know, of all that. Always glad to help.
All right. We'll be right back with Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, Catholic Answers Live.